This is The Guardian. Just a warning before we start, this episode contains references to suicide. Please take care while listening. Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal land with the full story.
It's a strange and privileged aspect of this kind of work that people will allow me into their homes and into their lives and open themselves up to me. It's sometimes in very raw emotional ways, and then entrust me with those stories. And I won't be writing it for the people I'm writing about. And so that's a tricky thing to navigate.
Patrick Radden-Keefe is an investigative journalist and author who's reached celebrity status. A writer for The New Yorker magazine, he's penned deeply researched international bestsellers such as Empire of Pain, which is about the Sackler painkiller empire, and Say Nothing, about an unsolved murder during the Troubles. And his latest book has continued to win him fans. London Falling tells the story of teenager Zach Brettler, who dies a mysterious death after pretending to be the son of a Russian oligarch. But the book is about much more than the family's quest for the truth. It also tells the story of money, greed, power, and failing institutions in London's modern age. Today, we're in the studio with Patrick Radden-Keefe as he returns to Australia for the first time in more than a quarter of a century to talk about the mystery he couldn't ignore. It's Tuesday, the 19th of May. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to The Full Story, and thank you for coming into Guardian Australia's studio.
It's great to be with you.
I don't know if many people know, but you actually have an Australian connection. Have you visited quite a bit? Did you spend time growing up here?
I did. My mum's from Melbourne and went to Melbourne Uni and then went off to England, which is where she met my dad, who's from the States, and they moved to Boston. So when I was growing up, I used to come every other summer for us, which was winter for you, and see my gran and my cousins and my aunts.
Does it feel like coming back home when you come back for the book tour?
It does a bit. I haven't been here in a long time, so I haven't been since 99.
Oh,
my grandmother died in 1999, and I've been meaning to come back ever since, and just for one reason or another, it hasn't happened. So it's been fascinating coming back.
Well, we might talk a little bit about that towards the end, but let's get into your book, London Falling. There are people who are listening who might not have read it. There won't be any spoilers, I promise, but it's essentially some of the themes are about crime and power in London today. And I just want to start with when you were first told about this case, this boy, Zach Brettler, who died in mysterious circumstances after posing as the son of a Russian oligarch. When you heard about that, did you immediately want to pursue it?
Yeah, I knew right away. I was living in London in the summer of 2023, producing a television drama for Disney based on my book, Say Nothing. And I met a stranger who was visiting the set that day. He was just a guest of the director. And he said, I know this family, and they lost a son who was 19 years old. And after he died in mysterious circumstances, they learned that he'd been posing as the son of a Russian oligarch. And he'd really said just about that much. And I knew if the family will talk to me, then I'm in.
You mean why this one? Because you must get a lot of stories sent to you with people asking you to pursue it.
I do. I'm very findable on the internet, for better or for worse. I mean, it's really important because very important sources in for each of my books have come to me. There were people I didn't know to go looking for. There are people who learned that I was working on the particular subject and just got in touch. So that means I do get a lot of approaches about things. And most of the time, the stories aren't for me for one reason or another. And in this case, you know, it wasn't even analytical. It was more that I was so intrigued, I felt myself kind of leaning in, which is, I think over the course of my career, I've gotten better at trusting my own instincts, that sort of listening to my own attention
span. There was that gut feeling that there was something there.
Yeah.
There's a lot in this book, but we're going to look at a couple of the main themes. And one of the lines going through this is police failure. Mm-hmm. They may not characterize it as that, but the London Metropolitan Police perhaps failed to adequately investigate what led to Zach Brettler's death. How were you able to find so much more detail than the police could?
Well, I think part of it is that there were very obvious investigative moves that they didn't make. People they didn't track down, people they probably should have spoken with who they didn't speak to. Part of it was that I was kind of drafting on the Brettlers, on the parents of Zach, the boy who died. So, you know, a big part of what this story is about is that this boy Zach dies in 2019. His parents are shocked by his death, and then doubly shocked to learn that unbeknownst to them, he had had this whole secret life as a teenager and been pretending that he was the son of a Russian oligarch. And then initially they place their trust in the authorities. The, you know, the Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard say, we're going to leave no stone unturned. We'll use all our resources to get to the bottom of this. And then they, in my view, kind of botch the job. And so the Brettlers then are forced to sort of become detectives themselves and do a lot of investigation on their own. And so in a kind of strange way, they were retracing the footsteps of their dead son. They were kind of seeing, where did he go? Who did he talk to? What was he up to? What messages was he sending? What businesses was he getting into? And I was then retracing their footsteps as they kind of went through and in some cases were talking to some sort of quite unsavory people. It was as if they followed Zach after his death and he kind of pulled them into this strange netherworld in London, which is where he'd been hanging out.
I mean, you have some astonishing detail that you document in the book of conversations with gangsters. How did you even get that detail?
Well, I had to track some of these people down. Some of them found me once word got out that I was working on this. But there was, you know, one of my big sources was a guy named Andy Baker, who was close with another guy named Indian Dave, who's a one of the gangsters nicknamed Indian Dave. His real name was Birinder Sharma. Mm. And Andy Baker had gotten out of prison. I heard that he'd gotten out of prison. I tracked down the name of a lawyer who'd worked with him. I tried to get a message to him. I ended up getting in touch through the lawyer with a friend of his who got word to him. He'd never spoken to a journalist before. And I sought him out and he agreed to see me.
It's just that good investigating that you're describing. What has the Metropolitan Police said about why they didn't do that sort of work?
Their position, such as it is, I mean, to the degree that they've been willing to articulate it, is that they actually did leave no stone unturned, that they pursued every avenue. I don't think that's true. I mean, I think that there are, again, sort of quite obvious people they never talked to, never bothered to talk to, and questions that they never really bothered to entertain. I will say, in fairness to them, there have been decades of cutbacks at the Metropolitan Police, and I think that it's fairly widely held view, and there have been people who've looked into this, there have been panels and inquiries and what have you, that the Met is not really fit to purpose when it comes to kind of investigative police work.
Well, do they believe that their position is not to investigate? Is that right?
Well, it's a little complicated. In this case, you had a boy who went off a balcony, and there would be a kind of logical question there. Was it suicide? Was it murder? Was he pushed? Did he slip? And then it emerged that there was footage of him going off the balcony and that he was alone on the balcony. And I think that for the police, what that meant was that it very quickly took off the table the prospect of a kind of straightforward murder investigation of a sort that you'd have if you thought he'd been pushed. The challenge is that Zach clearly jumps off the balcony of his own volition. And so the tendency would be to say, oh, well, this must be a suicide then, right? You don't jump off a balcony unless you want to kill yourself. The problem is that he was in the apartment with a very, very dangerous man, this guy who was known as Indian Dave, who was just in the process of figuring out that he'd been duped by this teenage boy, that actually Zach was not the wealthy oligarch's son that he'd been pretending to be. And there's other evidence that I was able to assemble that there was the prospect of real danger to Zach. And so that sort of brings up this third possibility, which is what if he jumped to escape? You know, what if he thought if he stayed in that apartment, he was going to die? And I think that the Met's position is that that's just a little too exotic for our tastes. You know, suicide, we can handle. Traditional murder, we can handle. But this third category that's a little more amorphous, that's not really the business we're in.
And since the book has come out, have they done any more on the case? Have they said any more?
Interestingly enough, they gave a new statement, I believe, to The Guardian in the days after the book was published, in which they sort of went beyond what they've said in the past. In the past, they've said, we're satisfied that we did our best on this investigation. And they went further this time and said, we believe that there was nothing suspicious at all whatsoever about the death, which I'm afraid from my vantage point, and I think the vantage point of people who read the book, is a bit of a self-disqualifying thing to say. I mean, there's a lot, whatever you think about what happened to Zach Brettler, there was a lot about his death that was suspicious, as spelled out in the book.
Let's go to some of the other core themes. The book documents a lot of modern London, the arrival of offshore money after the deregulation of the financial system, some Russian oligarchs, maybe some ill-gotten gains from the fall of the Soviet Union. Why do you argue in the book that that kind of money and influence changed London?
Well, I mean, for a variety of reasons, one of which is that I've seen it change London. I lived in London between 2000 and 2001. And I love London. I've gone back, you know, virtually every year since. I have dear friends there, and I've seen the city change. I think that the political leadership in London would acknowledge that the place had changed. There's a quote that I have in the book from Boris Johnson when he was the mayor of London, saying, "London is to the billionaire as the jungles of Sumatra are to the orangutan. We are their natural habitat, and we're proud of that." I think there was a very conscious effort with a golden visa program, I should just parenthetically say, of the sort that the Trump administration is now introducing in my country, to attract these kinds of people. There was a tendency to look the other way when the people who came with their riches were potentially a little dodgy. There's fairly wide agreement that there's been a huge amount of money laundering that happens in London. There's been massive amounts of real estate speculation. As I say in the book, there is a statistical correlation between the price of a residence and the likelihood that it is occupied. And so London is full of these very expensive dwellings that are actually empty for much of the year. The driving up of the prices means that ordinary Londoners in many cases are priced out of living in their own city. And then you get this kind of bizarre spectacle, which is all of this super luxe real estate that is empty much of the time.
Safety deposit boxes in the sky.
Yeah, exactly. So it creates a kind of strange, sort of eerie, antiseptic, depopulated feeling. And I think that for the Brettlers, what it meant was that they thought they knew their city. They lived a kind of comfortable upper middle class life in central London. They lived in Maida Vale. And then their son died, and it was like it sort of tore the fabric a little bit. And suddenly they could kind of see through and see this other dimension of the city that struck them as quite sinister.
I want to go back to something you just mentioned about Boris Johnson and billionaires. And I do wonder, so much of the book is about how modern London has been sort of corrupted by this new money. But what are your thoughts on whether England's history, landed gentry, class in England, made London simply more susceptible and ripe for exploitation? The structures were already there, essentially.
Oh, there's a lot in that question. I mean, I think that to some degree, that's right. And there are, if you read the book carefully, there are these strands having to do with the history of empire and the kind of complexities of the British class system and the sort of strange handshake that you get again and again between people who have class but actually need money and people who have money but need class. And that
or some have both.
Yeah, exactly. It's true. But you do often see these kind of interesting handshakes that happen. One of the questions that's come up since the book has been published is, to what extent is this a sort of uniquely London story? And I do think that there are elements of it that sort of draw on the very particular history of London. But having said that, when I went on book tour across the US for 3 weeks, there were these interesting moments. You know, when I was describing Mayfair, the neighborhood of Mayfair in London, in New York City, people were kind of didn't seem to connect to it all that well. New York is sort of a bit different. There's not the same kind of concentration of blingy wealth. When I went to Miami and talked about Mayfair, every head in the room was nodding. People felt as though they recognized what I was describing.
But I guess what I'm asking is that element of class in London, because I was reading about the Grosvenor family, you know, very wealthy, worth billions, own sections of property in Mayfair. And Gerald Grosvenor said in 2016, top advice to budding entrepreneurs, was to have an ancestor who was good friends with William the Conqueror.
Yeah. And
in your book, there's so much about how people want wealth but can't get it. Is there something unique about England that means that people are just always locked out and they're always trying to get ahead and can't?
Well, again, though, I don't know that it's wealth that's eluding them, because there are these very wealthy people in the story. And then my characters are kind of mostly sort of second and third tier people who are basically trying to sort of mop up some of that wealth, right? But you have, you know, again, whether it's people coming from the Gulf or the former Soviet Union or increasingly China, who come in with enormous amounts of money, the issue is trying to kind of buy social entree more than it is, you know, the idea of actually kind of breaking into.
But can they do that via existing structures, basically?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of what this story is about is that everything's for sale now in a way that historically it wasn't. And I should say, I think that that has had some kind of malign consequences, but I don't want to be too nostalgic about the earlier world. There's a quote in the book from a bank president. This is prior to the deregulation of the banking industry by Margaret Thatcher. And he says, you know, it was my policy on lending was quite simple. You know, had you gone to Eton? And if you had, then I would lend you money.
Right.
You know, I don't know that that's a system that we should be nostalgic for either.
But there's still, you know, we talk about Oxford and Cambridge, and that can open doors. But another element I want to ask you about then, sort of by extension of that, is London Falling has come out at a time where immigration has become a really central hot button political issue. Some of the people your book argues should have been investigated are migrants. Are you worried at all that some might read the book in this context and think this is an anti-immigration message?
You know, I trained as a lawyer before I became a full-time writer, and I have a tendency, I think because of that training, to always be on the lookout for the mines and the minefield, and even to write a little bit defensively because I anticipate certain bad faith readings. That was, I'm glad that you raised this, because I had a fear that there might be a kind of bad faith misinterpretation of the book that did read it that way, because the two villains are these guys who both of them are of South Asian extraction, though one of them is actually from Uganda originally. But I have to say that hasn't been the reaction to the book at all.
No one has said to you,
you're the first.
This is a message of new immigration bad, old immigration good. I'm the first.
Book's been out 6 weeks. You're the first. And I completely will concede that the, you know, there was just another big march in London in the last few days, in England in the last few days. That is part of the atmosphere. I think part of it may be that the kinds of people that we're talking about don't necessarily go in for serious nonfiction. And so the book nobody's made an effort to kind of weaponize the book in that way. But I guess the other thing I would say is, I think if you're reading the book closely, you will see that to me, the kind of cosmopolitanism of London is something to celebrate. The book tells a very sympathetic story about people, ejected by Idi Amin from Uganda, arriving in England, facing atrocious British racism, actually, when they arrived. So I don't know that my sympathies are kind of could necessarily be misrepresented in a good faith manner in that way. The other thing I would say is, this is a book about reinvention. It's about the reinvention of adolescence that all of us go through. It's about the particular, rather extreme reinvention of Zach Brettler. It's about the reinvention of London in recent decades, but also it's about Zach's grandparents. It's about Akbar Shamji's father, these people who, against the kind of backdrop of London, with this great metropolis as the stage, they're able to reinvent themselves, reinvent their family histories. And I don't think that's always a bad thing. I think sometimes it can be a thrilling thing. It's part of what makes a city dynamic and exciting, is that it's a place of possibility. It's a place where you can become something new and write a new story for yourself and your family.
And you do document positives of migration as well through the book. I guess anyone arguably can reinvent themselves if they want to. In the time we have left, I want to just come back to the story itself. Do you ever think of Zach Brettler now? the boy who's died in this book.
Yeah, I mean, all the time. How do you mean?
Does he come up in your memory? Because one of the impressions I had was a lost opportunity, because this was a smart kid with an incredible memory. And as I was reading, I thought, boy, this kid could have worked for MI5 himself or become a political journalist.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I have two adolescent boys myself. And I was having a conversation with a guy who's was a mentor to me, and his kids are older. And I was complaining that my sons have become, you know, kind of ornery monsters who don't want to hang out with me anymore. And he said, you know, the thing about adolescence is you have to think of your kid as just in a kind of orbit. And there's a period of time when they're on the dark side of the moon. But if you wait, they come back around the other side, they come back. And I think that the hardest thing with Zach's story and the hardest thing for his parents is that he sort of never emerged from the other side. He never got the chance to push through that period that we all go through growing up. That's quite difficult, in which we kind of become strangers to our parents, to our own families. But yeah, I think about Zach all the time. I think about what he could have been had he emerged on the other side.
You have spoken a bit about the toll that this story took on you. How do you carry this heavy load and responsibility for people's grief that's part of your work?
It is a responsibility. I'm glad to hear you put it in those terms. I think it's a strange and privileged aspect of this kind of work that people will allow me into their homes and into their lives and open themselves up to me. It's sometimes in very raw emotional ways, and then entrust me with those stories. And I think the challenge is, as I had to remind the brothers again and again over the years I was working on the book, I'm not a therapist and I'm not a rabbi and I'm not in PR. Eventually I'm a journalist, so I have to sort of sit down and tell the story with some degree of objectivity, and I won't be writing it for the people I'm writing about. And so that's a tricky thing to navigate. And there are a lot of details in this book that I think make the family uncomfortable. There are details that if they had editorial control, they would probably have left out of the book. But to their enormous credit, they understood why, in a story that's actually all about lying and deception and half-truths, I needed to tell a story that was kind of completely factual. So I feel like I have a duty of care to this family, and that's an ongoing duty of care.
Do you still talk to them?
All the time. Yeah, I text with them virtually every day. Because think about it from their perspective. This is a very private family who initially, you know, I broke the news of Zach Brettler dying 4 years after his death because they had kept it quiet. And to see their private grief written about, you know, in a book that's hundreds of pages of long, and then is in the shop window at Waterstones, where you get on the tube and you see somebody across from you reading about your family.
It's confronting.
It's a very strange thing. And part of what has happened is I've tried to just prepare them for the idea that this is going to be weird. There's no getting around the fact that it's going to be very strange.
We'll be right back. Just briefly, you're here in Australia for the Sydney Writers' Festival, and we alluded to this right at the very beginning, but you've arrived at a very interesting moment in Australia, discussions around immigration, wealth inequality, rising populism. I mean, you haven't been here since 1999. What's your impression as you come back?
It's been amazing to come back. Part of it has just been thrilling because I did spend a big chunk of my childhood coming back and forth. And I just saw a lot of family in Melbourne, and that was the most wonderful thing. I will say it's interesting on the kinds of questions you're talking about. And here again, I sort of feel the need to caveat and say that I think this is a thing to celebrate. Melbourne, and to a greater degree Sydney, feel much more Asian now than they did when I was here 27 years ago. And again, I don't think this is a bad thing. I can see that there might be some people who do. And I think part of what is so bizarre about this moment that we live in is that in our kind of polarized political dialogue, a lot of the things that some people most fear are the things that I would most celebrate, right? Sydney feels very kind of cosmopolitan to me, and it feels sort of a piece with its region in a way that maybe it did less so when I was here more than a quarter century ago. But it's so dynamic. I mean, there's so much going on, and the kind of slightly, some of it is also just where I'm staying in the city, but the idea of this being a kind of global metropolis rather than a kind of somewhat provincial one from the back of beyond, I think is good news for Australia. I do.
That's fascinating that you've got that before and after shot, especially at a time when everyone's talking about it. Very quickly, are you working on anything at the moment, maybe Australian cases? Can you tell us anything?
It's funny. I'm dying to find something here. I really am. And I did an interview in the Australian media probably 6 weeks ago, in which I said this, and I've been getting these wonderful notes from people because I'm very findable on the internet. I have a website, and people send me these notes pitching me stories here, and none of them have been quite right yet, but I am on the lookout. I just published a big piece in The New Yorker a few weeks ago about New Orleans, which is something I've been working on and off for 5 years, and I am going to be starting something new for the magazine soon. I don't know exactly what, but we're talking about different ideas. And then I have a new podcast that's in the works, and I'm writing a television pilot for HBO and keeping busy.
You're telling me that you've got enough on your plate.
I got plenty on my plate, but definitely on the lookout for a story that would bring me back to Australia.
Well, the book is London Falling. Patrick Radden-Keefe, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure talking to you. Thank you for having me on.
That was investigative journalist and author Patrick Radden-Keefe. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, sound design and mixing by Joe Koning, and the executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Regid Ahmed. See you soon.